is Pull Yourself Together with E. Shaver Booksellers.
Hello, I'm Jessica, a lifelong lover of books, wide-ranging reader, fan of obscure British literature, all things Douglas Adams, long sentences, music biographies, the Oxford comma, always up for travel, except during COVID, and of course, Jane Austen.
And I'm Melissa, an eclectic bibliophile and all-around nerd who also loves Jane Austen, comics, and cooking. Together, we run an independent bookstore in Savannah, Georgia. Each episode, we discuss the books we've been reading and recommend. Well, hello, everyone.
Hello, we're back.
Yes, back from England.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. This is our first podcast since we got back.
I know. It feels like that trip was like 6 months ago.
It does, because so much has happened in between there. Yeah, we've been busy.
Yeah, there's been a lot going on. But
we had a wonderful time.
Yes, it was beautiful and wonderful and a lot of fun.
Great guides, beautiful landscape, perfect English weather.
Mm-hmm. All the English guides kept apologizing for the weather. It was glorious.
It was lovely. It was exactly what I had hoped for.
Yeah, we missed the hurricane that came through.
That was.
Yeah. But all's good.
All is good in Savannah. Mm-hmm. And yes, we are just, and despite all of that, we did manage to read a few things.
I read a lot of things.
Being
on a trip gives you lots of time to read.
I know, it does. And lots of time to buy books to read later on.
Indeed. Lots of books made their way home with us.
Could there have been extra suitcases?
Yes, there were.
So TK Maxx, if you go to England and you find that you have bought, in fact, a lot of books, just head to the local TK Maxx and get yourself a suitcase.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, so Jessica, what have you been reading?
Well, I spoke with Regina Porter right after we got back about her newish novel. Not entirely new, but it came out in August. The Rich People Have Gone Away, which I thoroughly enjoyed. I had read Regina's last novel, The Travelers, and I enjoyed that as well. And this one, for a sophomore novel, it was just, I can't recommend it enough. I really love this book. It's a COVID book. It takes place in Brooklyn in 2020. Everything has shut down or is shutting down. We're right in the hot spot for COVID, and we're introduced to a cast of characters whose lives all end up coming together. And I'm not going to spoil it, so I'm just going to give you an overview. But you start out with Theo Harper and his pregnant wife, Darla, and they're kind of the center of the story. They have an interesting relationship, and this is all in the very beginning of the book. They're in a open marriage, and Theo, I think, may be taking advantage of this more than Darla. But anyway, they have an opportunity to head to upstate New York to a summer cottage that Darla's mother owns and Darla has grown up going to her whole life. And it gives them a chance at a break. And so they head out and Darla goes missing. And the rest of the book kind of centers around solving this mystery, but it's not like a Gone Girl scenario. She's really good. At first you think, oh, here we go. It's going to be Gone. No, it's not that. It's because it's COVID, it's almost like a locked room scenario where you have a very specific set of characters that are all brought together that are friends of Darla and Theo's or family members or living in the building. And you get a separate chapter on each one's life and what's going on. And ultimately, they all come together in the end in a way that's really unexpected. And I just think it's a great book about what was going on during COVID, the weirdness of that time, the different social situations where people were able to get away because they had money. Other people were forced to stay in the city, and how they were living their lives during this time. And I really can't recommend it enough. I hope that's given it enough of an intro to make you want to read it without spoiling it for you, because there is a mystery in the book.
Yeah.
And so
my only concern with that is I feel like people even still to at this point are like, I don't want to read about COVID. It's too soon. Like that, but like that, mm-hmm. don't want to be back in that headspace. And like sometimes, like some books that I've read that have been definite COVID books, I've felt that some of them that hasn't bothered me. It just depends on the book.
So this book for me captured the weirdness of this time and kind of helped me go back and remember it and feel kind of a solidarity with her and how she, Regina, the writer, saw the whole situation in the story. And it is not a hopeless book.
Yeah.
So I do want people to know that this isn't a book that's super depressing about COVID. This is a book that just takes all the things that were going on at the time, Black Lives Matter, inequality, you know, some people being able to get away and escape COVID while other people were stuck in the middle of it in New York City in this terrible situation. But it is in no way hopeless. And the character portraits, because she's a playwright, I think that she, like, you feel like you know these people by the end of the book. She does such good character sketches that it's worth reading just for that. Mm-hmm. Because I think when you're writing a play, you have to introduce your characters and make people feel like they know them in a very different way than when you're writing a novel. And I think she brings this into this novel. And it's really, it's an interesting book and it's worth your time.
Okay. Okay, so the first one I'm going to talk about, so I had talked about Bunny on a previous episode that I finally got around to reading that. So I was curious after reading Bunny to read other things that Mona Awad had written. Mm-hmm. So I read All's Well by her, and it was just as weird as Bunny is. So there definitely, the weirdness carries through, but this one focuses, it also happens at a college, but the focus is different. It focuses on Miranda, who is like a theater professor and is directing kind of the theater department's mm-hmm. play. She was a Shakespearean actress who actually was working in her field and was successful as an actress, but she fell off the stage during a performance and injured herself badly. And so has now, like, her career is basically over as an actress. She's living with this chronic pain situation. Mm-hmm. Her marriage was destroyed as a result of the chronic pain and everything she was going through. And so she's sort of floundering, basically. She's doesn't feel like she's getting well. She feels like the doctors that and all the specialists and the physical therapists and the acupuncturists, like all these people mm-hmm. that she's going to, just don't seem to believe her that her pain is real. And she's definitely, Mona Awad is definitely making a statement in this book about believing women and believing people right. who are in pain when they say that they're in pain. Like, most of these people are not just trying to get pain medication. Right. They're just trying to make what's hurting them stop hurting. And like, she doesn't even want to take pain medication because it doesn't really help her and it makes her feel terrible. So right. like, she's looking for an actual solution. But, while that's going on, she's putting on this play, and she's decided that she wants to put on the play All's Well That Ends Well, by Shakespeare, which is one of his lesser known plays. It was the one that she was starring in at the time that she fell off the stage. So it was sort of, it has this deep meaning to her. And her theater kids don't want to do this play. They want to do Macbeth.
Well, of course.
yeah. And so she's got this one girl whose family donates a ton of money to the department. And as a result, she always gets the starring role in the play. And she's kind of manipulating this coup behind the scenes to have them do Macbeth instead. And Miranda's out at a bar one night, like the bar that she and some of the other professors will go to have a drink after class. And there are these three strange men there, almost reminiscent of the witches in Macbeth. And they offer her this weird shining drink, and they're talking to her about the play that she's going to put on, and she's talking about her pain. And one of them tells her that pain is not necessarily something that stays with you. It can be transferred. And then weird things start to happen, and things start to unravel a little bit in all facets, which I don't want to tell any more about it because I think it's definitely worth reading. It definitely, it's just super weird. And if you've read Bunny, you'll understand what I'm talking about. It's that same sort of weirdness. But there's always, like I said, she always is saying something bigger with what she's doing. And yeah, I may not have completely understood the ending. It's okay. I still very much enjoyed the book.
Yes.
So it's All's Well by Mona Awad.
Yes. And Melissa was reading this while we were in England, and we had a lot of time together at dinner and other things. So I feel like I've read this book as well. and I thoroughly enjoyed the retelling of it. So I'm going to recommend it as well, just through that.
Well, yes. And she definitely tells the story better than I did.
So. You did a great job.
Well, thank you.
Yes. Yes. Well, I'm going to talk about something absolutely 100% completely different. So our Jane Austen book club read The Missing Manuscript of Jane Austen by
Siri James.
Siri James. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And it was a lot of fun. We really, I think as a group, when we discussed it, we really enjoyed it. I mean, there are parts of it that are mildly unbelievable, but it is a work of fiction, and it is, you know, Jane Austen sort of fan fiction. But she, it's two stories. So it starts out with Samantha MacDonald. She is in Oxford. She's on a trip with her boyfriend. He's at a conference in London, and she goes into a used bookstore, buys a 200-year-old poetry book that's kind of been looked over because it hasn't been rebound or anything. It's just in its original cardboard, you know, cardboard-ish cover to protect it. But and she starts flipping through it when she gets back to her her room, and she discovers a letter that she believes was written by Jane Austen in there. And the letter mentions, with regret, a manuscript that went missing. It's to Cassandra, that went missing at Greenbrier in Devonshire. And so she's like, well, I have a few days here, and I want to see if I can authenticate this letter and if I can possibly find it. So this is the first story that we have. So she goes to this Greenbrier estate, and she meets up with Anthony Whitaker, who is the heir for this estate. The estate is in disrepair. It's been his uncle owned it, or no, his father owned it actually, and it he's getting ready to sell it. Like, he has no interest. He works in London. This is not his thing. He doesn't want to deal with the weeds or anything else. And so they have a classic sort of antagonistic first meeting.
Oh, well, you know they're going to end up together.
I knew it the minute. No spoilers. But it's pretty obvious.
It's a pretty easy play to call.
Yes. So ultimately, they find the manuscript and they read it aloud to each other. And the manuscript, the way she writes it, is actually really good. And most of us were more engaged with the manuscript, which was the lost Jane Austen novel, than with the story of Samantha and Anthony and all of the stuff going on in the modern day.
Well, that seems just kind of tropey. So,
yeah. So it was a lot of fun. Her writing, mimicking Jane Austen, was actually very good. And
which is really hard to do. Lots of people try it and fail miserably.
I know. And Melissa knows that I strenuously object to novels like this. And this one, I had a good time with. I found myself wanting, you know, to know what happened next. And maybe skipping over the modern day part a little bit to keep with the Jane Austen-esque part of it. Mm-hmm. And it was just, I recommend this. It's just a really fun, comforting read. If you, I don't know, if you need a book like that in your life, this mm-hmm. is perfect for that, especially if you're a Jane Austen fan. And I would recommend it. Mm-hmm. It was group consensus was that we liked it. We had a couple of ideas about whether she was a genius in writing these two parts of the book in such different voices or not, but
okay.
Yes, but it was really good. And it is a good book group book as well. If you have a Jane Austen, sort of fan club book group, I would recommend this one to go on your list.
Right.
All right. What about you?
So the next one I was going to talk about is Leanne Moriarty's new book, Here One Moment, that we just talked about last night in our FOMO book club.
Mm-hmm.
I will preface this by saying this is the very first book by Leanne Moriarty that I've ever read.
Okay.
I haven't read any, like I haven't read Big Little Lies, mm-hmm. any of the ones that she's kind of really well known for. I haven't watched any of the shows that are based off of her stuff.
Okay.
But what I do know about her is that most of her books are kind of, if maybe a loose term thriller, but there's usually kind of a big aha reveal moment kind of mm-hmm. thing in them. So that's what I went into expecting with this one. And so the premise of this book is it starts out on a plane and a nondescript older woman stands up and starts going through the plane,
mm-hmm.
pointing at every single passenger on the plane and telling them what age she expects them to die at and from what.
Okay.
And I mean, and it's not just like, oh, you're going to die in your 90s from a disease. Like, she's very specific of the age. And some people get, you know, like the one flight attendant mm-hmm. Tells her she's going to die at the age of 28 from self-harm. It's the flight attendant's 28th birthday that day.
Well, that's not really fair.
She tells a mother that her baby is going to die at 7 from drowning. Like, she goes through the plane and
she's very specific.
Very specific.
I wouldn't care for that.
Well, no, I don't think most people would care for that. But then the book then alternates chapters telling the woman, whose name is Cherry, mm-hmm. kind of her life story leading up to this event. And then it follows six of the passengers whose death she predicted. And everybody just kind of thinks this woman was just having a
mental breakdown?
Like a mental breakdown. But three of the predictions come true.
Okay.
And so then it starts to really mess with the people whose lives mm-hmm. she made these predictions about. I would say, so the book is almost 500 pages long, 498 pages long. My personal opinion is that it could have benefited from a really tight edit. Like mm-hmm. it could have been 200 pages less. And I think you could have still told the story.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to ruin it, but I would say the ending was not what I expected to be. Like, there was not a big aha moment at the ending.
So she's deviated a little bit.
It was, I think the people who in book club who said they had read some of her books before also sort of had that same, like, this was sort of unexpected and it but I think it is, there are things in it that I think are interesting. One of the things that we were talking about, in book club is, does she have, like, does Cherry, who made these predictions, have a responsibility for what she did to these people's lives? Not necessarily, not like the people who died, but like she tells a husband and wife, like, who are literally on the plane in their wedding clothes. They just got married. She tells the new bride that she's going to die in 2 years from intimate partner violence. So basically her husband is going to kill her. And so,
yeah, so she's really changed people's lives. Right. Or the trajectory of them, potentially.
Yeah, so, like, even if the prediction doesn't come true, you've still messed with people's head to a point.
But what can you, I mean, what kind of retribution can you, I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, if you destroyed someone's marriage, like, I think that, I mean, like, because.
Yeah, but how, I mean. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know a good answer for that.
No, I don't either. And neither of us, none of us came to a conclusion about it. I just think it's an interesting thing to think about. It's that whole, like, discussion of, like, freedom of speech. Like, you can say something to somebody, but it's not freedom from consequences, right? So, like, I think it would be an interesting court case to bring for, like, emotional damages, because if you've... Or, like, the woman whose son, she says, is going to die at seven... is OCD. And so this ramps her OCD, like, out of control. She's got the kid in swimming lessons 7 days a week. Like, you know, so, you know, it, I think it, I think there are interesting things in it. I would say that having read The Immortalist by Chloe Benjamin, which is a kind of a similar story.
Yes, I've read that one too.
I enjoyed that one better because I think it did a better job of kind of discussing the idea of what would you do if you knew that you had this long to live? Is it a self-fulfilling prophecy? Do you make your death happen at that point by the way that you live?
Well, Chloe Benjamin's, and it's been so long since I've read it. We read it at the same time, but it seemed to have more of a magical realism element to it. Or a little bit. There seems something ethereal about it.
Well, I mean, it's the same thing. It's a psychic predicting when they're going to die. And but then there's also the discussion in this, like, is she actually psychic? Like, what, you know?
Where does this information come from? Yeah. It's a, well, I bet it makes a very good book club discussion.
Oh, yeah. It lent itself perfectly to a book club discussion. There was lots of opinions. But I mean, I'm not upset that I read it. I just feel like for a book that was as long as it was, I wanted more.
I can see that. All right. Well, that is a different turn for, I did. I watched, Big Little Lies back when it was all the rage. So, yeah, I am used to her more as a sort of suspense goddess and letting us know, like, big reveals. And
There wasn't, I mean, I didn't feel a ton of suspense in it, even though you're kind of waiting to see if these predictions come true. But it, I don't know, it just didn't feel like that.
All right. Well, I'm going to talk about something completely different. As we do. So I've been reading a little book called Glaciers that's put out by Tin House. And it is by Alexis M. Smith. And I don't know where I picked this book up. Somewhere in our journeys. But it's been on my shelf for a while, and for some reason, it was just its turn. And I'm delighted with it. The writing is beautiful. It, if you're a fan of books where a lot of stuff happens, this is not the book for you. This really takes place in one day, and it's Isabel, who's single and 20-something, living in Portland, Oregon, and works as a conservationist in her library, her local library. And I would say she's a romantic, and she kind of goes back and forth in her mind. She's very observant about what's going on in her day, and all of these observations are written down sort of from the way the sun feels on her leg in the morning when she's having her coffee, to how her cat rubs up against her, to her childhood growing up in Alaska and sort of the beauty of that. Her love of thrifting, and when she's thrifting, she has a habit of picking up old postcards that either have been mailed or haven't been mailed and pinning them up on the wall and kind of imagining the people's lives and the story, which is a whole nother interesting tangent that this book goes on. She dreams of traveling, but she's young and she really hasn't gone a lot of places yet. But also it brings in a few other characters, her parents' relationship. She meets with an astrologer and kind of gets a prediction of what her life is going to be. She also has an encounter with one of her fellow workers, and you get into his story a little bit, and it's just a book about a young woman's musing over the course of a day. And it's really good. It's really well written. It is a low time commit as far as, I mean, it goes very quickly. You could read it in one sitting. It's 109 pages. But the writing is just, it's just lovely. So if you have a Saturday and you just want to read something that kind of puts you in a reminiscent mood, I would recommend this.
Okay.
And I also would recommend it for the writing. But again, you have to be a fan of books where not a lot happens. So if you're looking for a highly plotted, twisty book, this is not the book for you. If you're looking for an introspective book of musings that are beautifully written, this is the book for you.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you are looking for a book with where something happens, I just read Kindred by Octavia Butler. And this has been on my to-be-read list for a really long time. My husband read Fledgling by Octavia Butler when he was taking his English master's program. And I've read two of her more sci-fi books that were in like the Lilith's Brood, I think, mm-hmm. is the series. But I read two of the three of those. But Kindred is one that I've always been interested in. And we're going to discuss it in our To Kill a Mockingbird book club in November. So it's very well done. It's also very hard to read. So it is set in 1976. Mm-hmm. That's the present time of the book. The main character is a young black woman named Dana. She's just celebrated her 26th birthday. She's a writer. She's married to a white man named Kevin, who is mm-hmm. also a writer and who is older than she is. They have not been married that long. They have just moved into like their first house that they've bought, and they're unpacking their stuff. And all of a sudden she begins to feel unwell and she becomes nauseous. And then she's transported to a river, and there's a young boy in the river who's drowning. and she jumps in and she saves this boy mm-hmm. and brings him to the shore and does mouth to mouth on him to bring him back. And his mm-hmm. mother is freaking out on the riverbed. And then the father shows up with a shotgun and threatens to shoot her. And then she's transported back into her present time. And so she's been gone in her head like 30 minutes, an hour. Mm-hmm. To her husband, she's been gone like 2 seconds, but she was on one side of the room and then appears on the other side of the room.
Interesting.
And she's soaking wet, covered in mud from the river. And so she then is, so the boy that she saved is a boy named Rufus. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that, and this happens, like this reveal happens very early on in the book, is that he is the father of one of her ancestors. And
okay.
So that she was transported back to the year 1819 mm-hmm. and Rufus is the son of a wealthy plantation owner. And she's got this connection now with Rufus that anytime Rufus's life may be in danger, she gets pulled back into the past to save him.
Interesting.
Yes. And obviously, as a very educated young black woman,
this is going to be difficult.
It is very difficult. Mm-hmm. At one point, her husband is pulled back into the past with her, and that causes problems because she's the one who's connected with Rufus. So when she goes forward again, mm-hmm. he's left in the past. And she never knows when this is going to happen. She refuses to drive in present day because she could be pulled out of the car at any moment. But it's, so there's that part of the plot, but there's also the part, you know, where she's back in this time mm-hmm. and she's being treated like a slave, and it causes tension between her and her husband because he can survive as a white man mm-hmm. and things are difficult. I mean, it's still the 1800s and you know, mm-hmm. he's a man from present time. So there's that acclimation, but it's not the same
right
for her. Mm-hmm. She's whipped by overseers. She watches slaves be sold away from their families. So it really is, it's difficult to read just because she's so, when she's in the past, because she is educated and like she doesn't fit in with the other blacks, but she also doesn't fit in with the white people. She's right. very, very othered. It's incredibly well done. Mm-hmm. I think it even very timely to read at this point as yeah. well. It's just, I've not read anything like it. And she, because she knows that Rufus is the father of one of her ancestors, she mm-hmm. has a vested interest in his future and in making right. sure he survives, but he is not a good person.
Okay. Well, that adds an yet another twist to it.
Yeah. It's really good.
Well, I am planning on reading that probably this weekend because I want to go to book club as well, and we're reading it for our To Kill a Mockingbird book club. Yeah. So you would recommend?
I would highly recommend it. Mm-hmm. It is incredibly well done. But again, it is difficult to read parts mm-hmm. of it. But I think what she's trying to say in the book is very important.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm looking forward to it, which sounds like a weird thing to say.
Yeah, I mean, it really was just mm-hmm. a really good read.
Well, I'm almost embarrassed to talk about my next one now. But it is, I did break down and jump back into listening because I just needed a break to my Lady Emily mysteries. And Yes. So this one is Death in the Floating City, which is number 7 in the Lady Emily mystery series. And so this one, in this one, Emily goes to Venice. Years ago, her childhood nemesis, Emma, scandalized polite society when she married a Venetian and moved to Venice. And now her husband has gone missing and her father-in-law has been murdered. And Colin and Lady Emily have been dispatched to kind of try to solve this because she is an English citizen still. And so you really go all over Venice to the libraries, to bordellos, to... And there's a story, there was a ring found in the father-in-law's hand, and this leads back to discovering this family feud that is still going on today, very much like a Romeo and Juliet, the Capulets. And so it puts her and her friend in danger, but yet, again, Lady Emily is able to triumph. And with a lot of twists and turns and a very surprising ending about whodunit, we get all the secrets out.
Oh, and, goodness.
Yes. And so it was a fun ride. I enjoyed it. And I do really enjoy her historical bits because it does make me go down rabbit holes and look up things that I either didn't know anything about or had completely forgotten about. Mm-hmm. And Venetian history is not something that I am particularly well-versed in, so this was fun to learn things about the city and about the people who were living there over the centuries. Mm. So it's a diversion. It's a guilty pleasure, but sure. I do enjoy these books, and they're fun to listen to. They really are. So... in this time, if you need something escapist, I would definitely recommend this to distract you from all the things going on in the world now, which is a lot.
Yes.
But Tasha Alexander does a good job, and her history is solid, so I appreciate that in her writing.
So I think the last one I was going to talk about is me continuing in my reading of Evelyn Waugh. So the one that I just finished is called Put Out More Flags. And I think this is probably my favorite of the books that I've read by him at this point. So in the author's note to this book, he talks about how this book was written when he was actually serving as a soldier in World War II. His tour of duty had ended and he was on a ship sailing home, but he was going around the Cape of Africa. So a long ship ride. And so he had a lot of spare time on the ship and he just sat down and wrote this book simply for the pleasure of writing a book, which he said he had never really done before. He had never just written something for fun. And he was like, and you know, whether that makes it good or bad, I don't really know. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. It is definitely a war book, but it's a war book as Evelyn Waugh does a war book where it's kind of ridiculous and satirical. We pick back up with our intrepid Basil Seal, who is one of my favorite characters. Like I love this guy and his just shenanigans, as he, his mother is kind of trying to get him a position in a regiment and is sending him off to talk to like friends of hers that are like colonels and they don't want him because they've met Basil and they know what he's about. And it's him basically trying to avoid any sort of real position in the war. He goes and stays with his sister whose husband owns an estate and she's become basically the billeting officer of this area and is in charge of taking evacuees from the city and housing them with people. And there's three children who are just a mess. Like the oldest one is 17 or 18 and she's a little bit of a floozy and, is very inappropriate. There's a middle son and then there's a younger daughter and the younger daughter is, not well, like has developmental issues. But the three of them are just a mess and nobody wants to keep them. Aww. So Basil comes up with this money-making scheme where he, he will take them to different places and say that he's the billing officer for the area and he has to house them there. And he finds people who he knows will not be able to put up with these kids and basically houses them with them long enough that they will bribe him to take them away. So, so he has kind of reached an accord with the three kids, especially the oldest one, where they know that this is the scheme. And so like they'll behave for him when they're at home with him and his sister, but then he takes them out someplace and they know to be just the worst. And so that's how he's surviving at the early part of the war is he's got this money making scheme and he does this. And which is hilarious. But then he ingratiates himself into a position in the Ministry of Information, which is just ridiculous as well. Again, it's just, it's Evelyn Waugh. It's funny. There are some things again that are of their time that are just not appropriate, but he's it's just ridiculous. And it's just ridiculous of like a certain class of people. But it was interesting because while we were in London on this last trip, we took a tour of the Mayfair neighborhood. And I came away from this tour being very angry because I felt like it was useless and we didn't get a lot out of it. But reading this book, there were lots of references to that neighborhood and specifically like the Curzon movie theater on Curzon Street. And I was like, oh, well, that was one of the first theaters that showed art house movies. And so like I did retain knowledge from that terrible, terrible walking tour. So it all came full circle.
Yep. So it did, in fact, have some value.
I mean,
literary value.
Yeah.
Well, small, and we got to see... Jane Austen's publisher's house.
That's true. We did we did see that. Well, publishing office.
Office, yes. Which still exists to this day in the same building, which is pretty cool.
That is kind of cool. But anyway, so I would highly recommend Put Out More Flags by Evelyn Waugh, especially if you like kind of World War II, but not
and
a serious...
And British humor.
British humor.
You have to like that particularly dry brand of British humor.
But it was fun.
Yeah. Speaking of which, what are you reading now?
What am I reading now?
We are at that point.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. So I just started last night a very, it's a small book. It's called The Prisoner of Ankara by Suat Dervis. It's being put out by Other Press in December, but it's actually a Turkish book that's kind of considered a classic in Turkey, but this is the first time it's ever going to be available in English. And it's about a man who is sent to prison. I don't know much more about it than that because I literally just started it. But I'm very curious because I've never read anything that I can think of by a Turkish writer.
Turkish? No, I'm trying to, well, no. So there's a book called Birds Without Wings, which is about living in Turkey and Greece during the time of the migration and wars and the end of the Ottoman Empire that I particularly like. But I'm so it takes place in that part of the world, but I don't think it's by someone who is actually Turkish.
Yeah. So so this would be the first thing I've read by someone who's Turkish that I can think of. And then I'm also deep in the Fellowship of the Ring at this point.
Yep.
We have gotten to Rivendell.
Okay.
Again, seriously, I don't understand how you listened to this and said that there was less singing in it than you remember, because I am to the point where I just skip it because I cannot handle it anymore. There is exponentially more singing than there needs to be in this book.
There is a difference when Andy Serkis is reading it to you than when you're reading it yourself.
Maybe.
I know, but Melissa and I have differing opinions on the Lord of the Rings series. And so I have not started The Two Towers yet, but it is on my list. I took a little break with my foray back into listening to Tasha Alexander, and now I'm listening to one which is just ridiculous, but I also love, called The Greatest The Greatest Nobodies of History, and it's by Adrian Bliss, who actually I think has a big TikTok presence, but
I would not know anything about that.
I'm personally not on TikTok, but I believe he is. But it's actually a lot of fun. It is sort of the lies. So the tagline for the book is "History belongs to the heroes, but to get the full story, sometimes you have to ask the side characters." And so he takes side characters out of all these actual historical incidents, and he starts out. So the first one is about the dog philosopher, and it's sort of epistolary about a guy writing, and he's like, "There's this guy in the street living in a big pot in front of my house, and he's naked. My birthday party is coming up, and can't you do something about this?" And then it ends up going back and forth. And then at the end of each one of these little chapters, segments, he actually gives a real history of what happened at the time. So it is interesting and kind of brushes you back up on things that you may have forgotten or not even known. And so it goes the dog philosopher, then the Vestal Virgins, which was a lot of fun, told from one of the virgins' point of view, where there's a rich nobleman trying to get her little bit of land that she's allowed to own. And then there's the plague, where the plague itself is actually a character. And they're in the club, which was actually on that Mayfair tour as well, the very exclusive club.
Oh, right.
Yep. So that's where it takes place. And I was like, I know where that club is. So there were things. Mm-hmm. And then there's one from The Master's Ferret, which is about Leonardo da Vinci, and it's about the ferret he uses in Woman with Irvine, which is the precursor to the Mona Lisa, and some people think a better work of art.
It is 100% a better work of art than the Mona Lisa, so, the most underwhelming piece of art in history.
So it's told from the ferret's point of view. And then the next one is A Visitor to Strasbourg. And this is a bit of history that I didn't know anything about. The Dancing Plagues of Strasbourg that took place in 1518, mm-mm, where up to 400 people just danced until they dropped around the city. And they still, to this day, really don't know what caused it.
Was it one of the Sanderson sisters from Hocus Pocus? Because she does put a curse on the parents to dance and dance until they die.
Well, it is a similar curse, and some people think it's a particular saint that has made this happen. There were theories that it may have been in the grain, you know, the mold on the grain causing mass hallucinations.
That's what happened in Children of the Corn.
Yes, well, but in the end, because, and it happened up and down.
Well, they didn't dance in Children of the Corn.
No, they were creepy, though.
You think?
Yes. So, well, it is Halloween today, so... So it just does all of these little bits of history, but then gives you the real scoop at the end in a very entertaining way and in a very Monty Python-esque British humor sort of way. So if you're looking for something, like this would be great to listen to in the car. Mm-hmm. It's actually a book as well, so you can read it, but it's a lot of fun to listen to. And I am remembering and learning new things.
That's always good.
And I'm listening to the new Murakami, which is not disappointing me at all. It has all the classic Murakami elements, but I'll talk more about that next time.
All right. Well, so for our reading challenge, like the prompt for October was read a book with a cover you don't like.
Okay.
So
Jessica has read this book too, and we both love the book. I hate the cover though. It's called Deep Cuts by Holly Brickley, and it doesn't actually come out until February 25th.
Mm-hmm. It is a great book.
So there may be time for them to change this cover, because I think the cover is pretty terrible, but the book is incredibly, incredibly well done. Mm-hmm. It happens in like, I think it starts in the year 2000. Mm-hmm. So it's people who are in college in the year 2000. So it was right exactly the same age as me. I felt very much like seen, and I was, you know, back in my college years. But it's almost as if High Fidelity had a female main character mm-hmm. who wasn't a complete dick like Rob is in High Fidelity, because Rob is kind of the worst, but I love High Fidelity,
but
as well.
It's got a little hint of Tomorrow, Tomorrow, and Tomorrow in it.
Because there's the kind of the friendship aspect mm-hmm. of it, and how the friendship and the relationship sort of between Percy, who is kind of like the Rob character, mm-hmm. And Joe, who is a musician in it follows their relationship, and how their relationship kind of ebbs and flows, and how they're closer and not so close at certain points, and just them becoming adults and mm-hmm. all of that sort of change that happens.
But it's got a soundtrack too, which stick in your head, which is great. And it's about 10 years after I graduated from college, but the music is all very familiar to me and all things I loved. And it really does bring back that nostalgia when Melissa and I were talking about it, of just that freedom when you're in college, where you just spend time with all these people and you're all in and out of each other's houses and apartments and mm-hmm. lives. And it's just it's so different from how grown-up life is.
Yeah. Well, and there's there's a moment where Percy, Joe, and then another character who kind mm-hmm. of figures into the book a lot, they don't want to go home for Christmas break. So they're spending time together while everyone else is gone, and they're just back and forth from each other's houses, sleeping in random beds, all of this stuff. But they're going through, like, they'll be like, what's the best song about this? And so they'll just start going through their CD booklets and playing all of this music. Mm-hmm. And it's just so nostalgic
for those of us nerds who did this in college and high school, and kind of missed that. That was so much fun, but I can't imagine now at this point in my life, like, playing my favorite song for you. It would just be weird.
I don't know.
Maybe.
I mean,
my record player is right here.
I play music in the office all the time. So, you know, like,
I listen to music, and I actually have a playlist going in my head most of the time too, because I'm weird. But just that intimacy in people who aren't your family, your husband, wife, whatever, partner, that doesn't happen so much after you mature and go off.
Yeah. I mean, it's that like those kind of like moments where music just, or like mm-hmm. specific songs just seem like so poignant and so like important. I mean, and there's always going to be music that's important to people based on like various things in their life, but it's just like where every song kind of has that importance.
Right.
I think my biggest takeaway, there was one line in the book where Percy is talking about how she worked at a record store, but she didn't really get along with the other people who worked at the record store, because they always wanted their knowledge to be so broad, and they wanted to know about everything. They didn't mm-hmm. want to go deep on things. And she specifically says, and this just, it's the perfect encapsulation for how I feel about music, is I didn't get into music. I got into songs because I love the specificity of like, I'm not like the classic rock person who loves all classic rock. Like I love specific songs. Like, and my playlist that I have is never like, it just goes all over the place because I love songs.
Right. And I love songs. And I'll take it even further with, I'm definitely a lyrics person. I mean, the music has to fit with the lyrics and it has to be right. But the lyrics are important to me. Just I like jazz and classical music and music that doesn't have lyrics. It's a different kind of music, and I use it in a different part of my life. But the music that sticks with me, that's meant something to me, it's the lyrics. I'm listening to the lyrics. Mm. And the way they fit with the music and the way it all works together that evokes that particular emotion in me.
Yeah.
And anyway, I can't wait till it comes out because it's really good.
It is really good.
They just need to change the cover.
Yes.
Don't let that hold you back.
No.
It's a great book.
No.
It's Holly Berkeley's book, Deep Cuts.
Yes.
And then for November, the prompt is a classic you've never read. And there's plenty of those. Yeah. So I'm not sure what I'm going to read for that as of yet. But
Well, if I read Kindred this weekend.
Actually, no. You know what? You know what I'm going to read for that? Brideshead Revisited.
Oh, there we go.
Because I've never read it.
Oh, God, I hope you don't hate it. It's my favorite Evelyn Waugh book. Partially for sentimental reasons, but partially I just love that book. When I was young, my parents got into the miniseries that they did on the BBC, and I watched it with them, and I have very happy memories for that. And then I read the book for the first time in high school, and I've reread it a couple of times. And so I am sentimentally attached to the book. Anyway, so I hope you like it.
we'll
pressure.
See. Yeah, no pressure at
no
all.
No pressure at all.
All right. Well, again, if you all are reading along with us for our reading challenge, be sure to fill out our little template thing or however you want to do it, but just tag us in it or send us a message on Instagram, because if you do finish the challenge, you're eligible to win a $100 gift card to the store. And I think that's all for right now.
Happy reading.
Yeah, happy reading. And
happy November almost.
Yeah, we'll be back in the thick of the holiday season.
Yep, we sure will.
All right.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.